everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2025, and you are listening to episode 462, which is an in-depth conversation about the classic apologetics work, The Book Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton, which was published more than 100 years ago in 1908. Today's guest is Rebecca Valerius. She holds a B.S. in biochemistry from the University of Texas at Arlington and an M.A. in apologetics from Houston Christian University. She is the president and a senior fellow at the Society for Women of Letters. Rebecca has written an online book review for the Christian Research Journal. Her review is called G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy and Christian Enchantment. You can read this review for free at equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Rebecca, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, as I noted, today we're going to talk about a really classic Christian book, and it's called Orthodoxy, and it's by G.K. Chesterton, the Roman Catholic writer. Now, some people might be familiar with him more for some of his fiction writing, perhaps, but maybe some of you, this is the first time you've even heard of G.K. Chesterton. So could you give us a little bit of background on him and let us know why he is important in Christian apologetics?
Yes. So G.K. Chesterton is probably known today in most Christian circles for being an important influence on C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and Dorothy Sayers. I first heard about him probably 20, 30 years ago as a young Christian. And actually, I saw pictures of him before I read any of his book, and his pictures are always so grumpy. And I thought, oh, he must be so grumpy. I never read him, but it was really C.S. Lewis that sort of led me into taking his writing more seriously. Lewis said that in his autobiography that Chesterton's writing was responsible for, quote, baptizing his intellect when he was a young atheist. And he called Chesterton's other classic book, we're talking about Orthodoxy today, but his other classic is called The Everlasting Man. He called that the best popular defense of the full Christian position he had ever read. And yeah, so Chesterton was a huge influence on these guys. So he was born in 1874. And I always remember this because I was born in 1974, so 100 years difference. But he really came onto the public radar in the early 1900s with his writing. And not unlike C.S. Lewis, Chesterton went from unbelief to belief. And it's actually this book, Orthodoxy, that he traces that journey. And Orthodoxy was written in 1908. But I would say, like you mentioned, most people might be familiar with his fiction because he was more than just an apologist. He was an incredibly prolific writer and journalist. So he wrote many novels. Most people might be familiar with The Man Who Was Thursday, which is a bizarre and amazing novel. He wrote many short stories and lots of brilliant, fun essays. He's also pretty famous for his detective fiction, the Father Brown series. He also wrote plays, lots of poems, and copious newspaper columns. I don't know if he ever slept, actually. and then he was definitely an apologist. He wrote and then participated in public debates. He debated Bertrand Russell. He debated Clarence Darrow, the famous Scopes monkey trial lawyer. I highly recommend people to go Google that. That was a very interesting exchange. So yeah, very important figure.
The title of your article is G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy and Christian Enchantment. You begin by pointing out that in Christian circles today, there are numerous conversations taking place regarding disenchantment and reenchantment. First, can you please define for our listeners the terms disenchantment and reenchantment, and then can you share a bit of context for this conversation I mean, why do you believe Chesterton's book adds something meaningful to it?
Yeah, so the argument in its simplest form is usually goes like this. So in prior ages, pagan religions, ancient pagan religions, pre-Christian, often deified and worshiped the natural world. So they saw the supernatural as being pretty exclusively immanent. Sometimes they had this idea of a god that's transcendent, but it was the immanent gods, little g, that they were very hyper-focused on. And then we have the modern era, given advances in reason and the sciences, and especially that of philosophical naturalism via the sciences, the modern world has been disenchanted or disabused of this pagan, idolizing, what I call hyper-enchanting impulse. Now, the actual idea of disenchantment extends back beyond our day, as far back as the early 1900s, to the work of the German sociologist Max Weber. If you ever had to take a sociology class in school, I did. You read some of his stuff. He's famous for the Protestant work ethic. But he noted that our times, really since the dawn of Christianity, but especially in recent times, probably since, you know, right before the Enlightenment, maybe the scholastic era, is characterized by a rationalization and intellectualization of the world and religion. And above all, he calls, that's when he used the word, we have the disenchantment of the world. And he argued that given Christianity, disenchantment was inevitable, for unlike the prior animistic religion that tended to deify the natural world, Christianity speaks of what he says, the divine going beyond nature and standing above it. So we have, Christianity has the transcendent God. Now, of course, Christianity's God is transcendent and immanent because we have the incarnation. I don't know if Weber talked about that in his work, but so that's kind of the idea of disenchantment. But many would argue today that the modern project has gone too far. So not only has it sort of extirpated the immanent God's little g, but it has also discarded the transcendent God, the God of Christianity, and in the process, meaning and purpose. So we have this thing called the meaning crisis. And then some would even argue further, and I think they're correct, that the current situation has progressed to the point that disenchantment has exhausted itself in a sense, and enchantment is returning with a raging ferocity. I liken it to like a starved bear that has emerged from a long hibernation. So years of deprivation have resulted in many moderns reading enchantment into anything and everything. In many ways, it might not be true or edifying. In fact, a few years ago, I think you remember I reviewed a book for CRJ by the sociologist Tara Isabella Burton called Strange Rites, in which she looks into the beliefs of the so-called nuns. So these are the people who check none on the surveys about religion. And atheists like to hold this up all the time as saying, see, God is in retreat, right? The God belief is in retreat. But what she found is far from being disenchanted, like these atheists would like to think, this rapidly growing demographic is what I would call hyper-enchanted and kind of going back into this ancient pagan thinking. They're worshiping anything and everything under the sun. So the really amazing thing about this, and I found this out when I was reviewing this book, and of course I do a lot of research into Chesterton. He saw this over 100 years ago. So he saw Spiritism. There was a big boom in Spiritism in England when he was a young man. You might know who Arthur Conan Doyle is, a writer of Sherlock Holmes. He got into it. They were having seances and Ouija boards. He saw both this extreme enchantment, hyper enchantment, but he also understood the disenchantment. He was affected by the disenchantment as a young man in art school. He saw the meaninglessness of it all. So he has this great quote that I share in the article. Religion is returning from her exile. It is more likely that the future will be crazily and corruptly superstitious than it will be merely rationalist. So he saw there's this tension between a rationalist approach to the world and then this crazy sort of pagan approach. So in Orthodoxy, what he does as he systematically works through all the different ways the world has tried to approach this tension of being in the world, as we would say as Christians, but not of the world. And what he discovers is that Christianity is the best way to reconcile this two needs, to have wonder at the world and see meaning and purpose, but also not to worship it. And so this is why Orthodoxy really is a work of apologetics. It's a defense of the Christian faith. And you will find in it the argument for morality, the argument for reason, even some contingency arguments. His contingency argument is one of my favorites, because I think it directly challenges David Hume in some fascinating ways. But also, Chesterton was a literary and visual artist. He trained as an artist. He actually dropped out of art school. He never graduated college. So he was particularly sensitive to the beauty and the wonder of these truths. So it's what's amazing about his work is Orthodoxy is it can kind of combine both of these and satisfy both of those needs, the rationalism of the disenchanted world and the enchantment of the pagan world, if that makes sense.
We hope that equip.org is one of your favorite bookmarks that you visit often, because our website includes thousands of articles and all of it is absolutely free. We hope that you will go and search around for all kinds of different content that we have. Of course, our articles from the Christian Research Journal going back almost 50 years worth of content that we have up there, book reviews and film reviews and in-depth theological articles and research that we've done on aberrant Christian theology, as well as cults and world religions, and of course, all of the audio content from this podcast with author interviews, Postmodern Realities, as well as our newer podcast that was started in January last year in 2024. That's Christian Research Journal Reads, which is audio versions of all of these articles that we're talking about. If you're commuting or working out or just doing some chores around the house and listen to podcasts, please listen to our audio articles of all of the articles that we are featuring their authors on this podcast, as well as our other podcast from Hank Hanegraaff, which is Hank Unplugged, and of course, our long time running broadcast, which is also in podcast form, the Bible Answer Man, where CRI President Hank Hanegraaff answers theological questions that people have. And so we have articles, we have videos, and we have our audio podcast. So please make sure that you are regularly exploring equip.org. And thank you also for being a partner to this podcast by being a faithful listener, by liking and subscribing our content on social media, by sharing your favorite episodes through a text, through an email, or on social media. We are so grateful. And if you could take a moment, if you haven't already, to rate and review the Postmodern Realities podcast on Apple Podcasts, we would be so grateful, because that is a way that the algorithm suggests this content to potential listeners, that we can be a part of their listening subscriptions and equip other Christians that would like to listen to this kind of content. So thank you so much. And now back to my conversation with Rebecca Valerius about Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton. So in your article, you contrast two different approaches to enchantment that Chesterton talks about. You know, you just mentioned the ancient pagans and then today's approach with scientific naturalism, which is post-scientific revolution. So how did they approach it differently? And what did Chesterton see as the potential, you know, challenges with each approach?
Yeah. So I like to think of it this way. It may be a bit oversimplified, especially with regards to ancient religion. But for the pagans, the gods, little g, were immanent. They were in this world. And of course, for many moderns, especially the disenchanted moderns, the supernatural is simply non-existent. So you could say maybe the pagans read too much meaning into the world and the moderns no meaning. So the pagan, they had this sort of hyper enchantment. They tended to worship creation and worship creation in nature. It was worthy of reference. These systems were typically polytheistic, so they deified the natural world. And yet, Chesterton notes that such elevation of the natural world inevitably led to the elevation of the unnatural. And he has this wonderful quote. He says, "A man loves nature in the morning for her innocence and amiability. At nightfall, if he is still loving her, it is for her darkness and her cruelty." So he notes that nature worship's fatal flaw is its failure to distinguish between the goodness and wonder, the enchantedness of creation, and its fallenness. You know, we have to recognize that there is this thread of cruelty and corruption, per Romans, the book of Romans, running throughout nature in the fall, right? We have to recognize there's been this fall. Otherwise, we might start seeing the corruption is actually good and even start to imitate it. And that's what he noticed was a problem with the ancients. For the modern, I call it pessimistic disenchantment in my article. The modern rationalist sees creation's cruel thread and corruption and interprets it as proof that, see, nature has no meaning and purpose. So for the typical pessimist, disenchanted pessimist, like, you know, your Sam Harris's of the world, the universe is comprised of nothing more than energy and matter that behaves according to impersonal fixed laws. We also have the very disenchanting creed, and even Max Weber, I think, pointed this out, of Darwinism. It's extremely disenchanting because it takes the purpose that we do see and says, well, that's just an illusion. So you have the core of Darwinist creed is aimlessness and chance, where life arises out of blind processes and random mutation and natural selection. And it says, and Richard Dawkins is famous for this, any appearance of purpose, even our sense of wonder at the world, is an illusion created in us by our genes, because it created in us by these blind processes of random mutation and natural selection, because it conferred some kind of survival value in our evolutionary past. So there's aimlessness, meaningless, and purposelessness. And so when we have this sense of the sacred, as the pagans did, it's really a lie. And the world is indeed incorrigibly disenchanted. So ironically, this approach, Chesterton notes, is just as unnatural as the pagans, and it slips into its own cruelties. Because obviously, if value and purpose are illusions, anything is permissible. And modern pessimism also ends in a kind of deterministic fatalism, just ironically, like ancient pagan religion. He says, not only does the skeptic do away with original sin, with his destruction of objective morality, he destroys any grounds for giving hope to anybody. And so in the end, this view ends up stripping the world of too much enchantedness. And Chesterton says the whole thing has shrunk and the whole life is somehow more gray, narrow, and trivial.
How do you think that Christianity resolves these difficulties?
Yeah, so Chesterton notes that first we must, you know, acknowledge that something has gone terribly wrong with the world to avoid the extreme of hyper-enchantment. There is a thread of cruelty woven into the fabric of reality, if you will. And something or someone must be positioned over and above nature, insisting that we do not imitate it. And yet this thing still gives, this person still gives the world value, meaning, and purpose. And Chesterton notes, the God of Christianity stands outside his creation, not unlike how, say, a poet stands out a poem he's composed. And likewise, we can see that the cruelty that we observe in the natural world is not native to it. We can still marvel at creation without worshiping it. And so that's really important for the pagan hyper-enchanter. For the pessimist disenchanter, the fall answers the thread of cruelty that they see, the disteleology. Some aspects of creation seem futile. The Apostle Paul, again, tells us in Romans that this world is groaning, and it is in the bondage to corruption. But we also know that the futility is not native to God's original design. So really, for Chesterton and for all of us, the key thing that reconciles this tension is the doctrine of the fall. And again, Chesterton returns to the analogy of an artist. He mentioned a poem and a poet. And then he said, and I love this quote, he said, God has not so much written a poem, but rather a play that he planned as perfect, but which had necessarily been left to human actors and stage managers. And maybe also we would say maybe angels as well, who has since made a mess of it. And then we also can't forget that the incarnation of our Lord speaks to both the pagan and the modern, because he's not so transcendent. You know, we don't have a deist God. He's not so transcendent as to refrain from actually entering the final act to rescue the whole show. And of course, we know he upholds the whole show constantly. So he's very intimately involved with creation.
So you mentioned how Christianity's view of enchantment has had some effects. So I would like you to share a couple of those.
Yeah. So the consequence of Christianity being able to reconcile both these perspectives, you can see it just, I say in my article, it reverberates down the millennia since our Lord's passion and resurrection. Obviously, the scientific revolution owes so much of its success to Christian assumptions that we live in an orderly and rational universe governed by a good and rational God who has created our intellect such that we can trust our reasoning ability. For the most part, we still sometimes have bad logic, but we can correct that, right? So all of these things are very fundamentally Christian and specifically Judeo-Christian assumptions. Scientific revolution owes so much of its success to that. And we can also retain a sort of pagan wonder and enchantedness, you know, sense of enchantment at all that God has made without ever feeling compelled to worship or read too much into nature. And I love how Chesterton puts this. I bring this up in the article. He notes that this sort of the Christian sort of double approach here fosters a kind of loyalty to existence that frees one up to love the world enough to protect its sacredness, yet hate the world's darkness enough to resist conforming to it and not totally trust it, right? And he likens this Christian view to that of a cosmic patriot. So just like a true patriot loves his country enough to both fight for it and still criticize it, so does the cosmic patriot. And so he says this blending of pagan and pessimistic perspectives is not a mere mixing to produce a less concentrated version of both. Something I like as a chemist here, I'm always teaching my students about dilution and reaction strength and everything. So it's not a mixing and a dilution so that neither impulse dominates. He argues in Orthodoxy that Christianity maintains both instincts intact with all their passions and fiery impulses. So he says, quote, on the system, one could fight all the forces of existence without deserting the flag of existence. Kind of like the disenchanter does. One can be at peace with the universe and yet be at war with the world. So Christianity's balance of all these apparent contradictions, he calls them, is what really helps true enchantment succeed. And in one area is the case of human dignity. I think this is the one that stands out perhaps the most, where improper enchantment or disenchantment has caused the greatest damage.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because you point out that a wrong view of enchantment is showing up in how we treat human dignity. And Chesterton is saying that, you know, both the ancient pagans and the modern pessimists got it wrong. So what does he say about that?
Yeah, so he notes that both kind of converge in these cruel ends in their attempt to address the apparent very real that we all see. We have this incredible extreme of the greatness of humanity and its equally as clear wretchedness. Blaise Pascal pointed this out a lot, the great French mathematician, apologist, Christian apologist in his day. I have to share this one quote from it. It's one of my favorite on the wretchedness and the greatness and wretchedness of the man. He said, through space, The universe encompasses and swallows me up like an atom. Through thought, I can comprehend the world. And that right there captures this greatness and wretchedness. There's a tension. I mean, we have an obvious variance with respect of all of creation. You compare us with the highest animal group, like the chimpanzees. I tell this to my students all the time. And there's just a huge chasm between us. Chesterton talks about this a lot in his book, The Everlasting Man. He says, you know, we may be a result of evolution, as some scientists claim, but man is still a revolution out of everything that has been made. But nevertheless, our existence is precarious as that of the beast of the field, and sometimes more so. Our ability to survive in nature, you know, is very limited. So Chesterton notes that both the pagan and the agnostic arrive at a sort of what I call a bland midpoint between these two extremes of greatness and wretchedness. He writes that, quote, the average pagan, like the average agnostic, would merely say that he was content with himself, but not insolently self-satisfied, that there were many better and many worse, and his deserts were limited, but he could see that he got them. And Chesterton observes that this position is actually quite reasonable, save for one significant objection. He says that this is actually reductive. So when you blend the human greatness and wretchedness, again, it's like mixing two things and diluting them, and it ends up diminishing human value. And he writes that human dignity is diminished because such a diluted pride does not, quote, lift the heart like the tongue of trumpets. You cannot go clad in crimson and gold for this. Basically, you won't fight for this. And such mild, rationalist modesty does not cleanse the soul with fire and make it clear as crystal. So human dignity is not so precious as to merit fighting for it with every last breath, even perhaps dying for it, ironically. And this perspective is also too weak to grasp the depths of depravity in every human heart, which necessitates such radical redemption that Christianity offers. So I love how he says, such a delusion loses the poetry of being proud and the poetry of being humble. But again, Christianity takes these two extremes so apparent in humanity. It even exaggerates them, Chesterton observed, yet it still reconciles them. So he says, one can hardly think too little of oneself. One can hardly think too much of one's souls. So out of all the creeds that he surveys in Orthodoxy, only this story of these beloved image bearers of God, but bounded by original sin, is what best preserves human dignity. And I think, you know, many other authors and writers have noted this, that history has revealed this, that as the Christian creed has slowly worked its way through human culture and the human heart, age-old institutions such as slavery and caste, things that were very entrenched in pagan thinking, that were just taken for granted, have slowly begun to crumble. And so I like he has this great quote here. Christianity preaches an obviously unattractive idea, such as original sin, but when we wait for its results, they are the pathos and brotherhood, and they are pathos and brotherhood and a thunder of laughter and pity. For only with original sin can we at once pity the beggar like never before and distrust the king. So at the foot of the cross, the greatest and least of these are made equal. So this is how it actually preserves human dignity in the best possible way.
That's really great. And I would like you to press into that even further, because it's the idea of these two things that show up in humanity. So according to Chesterton, you know, how does Christianity uniquely answer both, you know, the greatness of humanity and the wretchedness of humanity that you just mentioned in terms of like human dignity? But how does Christianity answer that without falling into the trap that other worldviews have in trying to talk about balance both of those aspects of humanity?
Yeah, it's amazing how it does it. So this is one of my favorite ideas from Chesterton when I first understood it. And it's a big part of his argument in Orthodoxy is that, you know, we live in this world of extremes. We need to be in the world, but not of it. We need to feel a sense of welcome in the world, but we're also at war with it. He says some elsewhere, well, it's in Orthodoxy, he has this idea that we are all had this feeling of being homeless at home. So this is our home, but we feel still homeless in it. And Christianity speaks to that very real sense. And he says that Christianity's unique capacity to hold this tension between opposing extremes creates in its followers this view of the world that is stereoscopic. He says, quote, the Christian can see two different pictures at once and yet see all the better for it. And he points out there's other extremes. Okay, we have the human greatness, human wretchedness, creation's goodness and fallenness. We also have disparate realities such as the tension between human freedom and moral responsibility and God's sovereignty. We have another one he talks about is the profanity of suicide, yet the glory of martyrdom. That's a paradox. We also have in Christianity unconditional forgiveness and forgiveness for our enemies, and yet we have absolute justice as well. So Chesterton contends that the Christian creed can accomplish this sort of reconciling of extremes because at its core are two realities that are equally as contradictory as all the extremes of this world. We have the tremendous figure of the God-man Christ, fully God and fully man, his incarnation, and then his humiliating crucifixion for our sake, which I think he would say this is what at least at the heart of our faith is also are also these extremes.
In your article, you share a quote from Chesterton that the Christian's sight is stereoscopic. So what does he mean by stereoscopic?
Yeah, so this means he can take these contradictions, like I mentioned, like human greatness, human wretchedness, God's sovereignty, human moral responsibility and free will, and it allows for us to, because Christianity itself is at the core, has these extremes of the incarnation and the passion of Christ and the resurrection. I mean, coming back from the dead is, you know, a total unexpected extreme. Because of that, the Christian can take these things and still hold them as both being true, right? They're paradoxes. Chesterton loved paradox. They're seemingly paradoxical. So that's, I think, what he means by stereoscopic.
So I want to ask you specifically about the life of Christ and the idea of enchantment in the world. Like, so how does the incarnation of Christ and his passion, you know, his betrayal and his arrest, trial, crucifixion, death, and his burial, how do those things about the life and the death of Christ contribute to the proper enchantment of the world?
Yeah, this is something I love about Chesterton's orthodoxy, and you can also see this in The Everlasting Man. He's continually going back to the mysteries and contradictions, the seeming contradictions at the heart of our faith. So the incarnation, again, is one of them. We have this tremendous figure of Christ. He was fully God and fully man. We can only state it. You know, it's hard to rationalize this, but we state it. And then, of course, we have his humiliating death on the cross, one of the worst ways to die. We can't really fathom today what it was like, crucifixion, and how shameful it was. And he did that for our sake. And speaking of the incarnation, I love what he says in The Everlasting Man, because I think this really captures the contradiction. He said, the hands that made the sun and stars... So in the incarnation, the hand that made the suns and stars were too small to reach the huge heads of cattle. That's mind-blowing. I remember talking this recently with my students, and they were like, well, was he upholding the universe when he was in the cradle? And I'm like, that's a deep theological question. But yes, I believe he was. This, you know, you take all of scripture, it's very strange. And actually, so in his humanity, even Christianity emphatically declares that in his perfection, our Lord was actually more human than we are because he was a perfect human. So I love that Chesterton mentions in Orthodoxy that we can see his very compassionate tears, but we can also see his fiery rage. So he has compassion for a city that was about to crucify him, a motherly compassion, even. He talks about being a hen gathering the chicks. But then he had table-throwing anger, you know, at the hypocrisy of the religious leaders, threatening them with hellfire. And you know that Jesus talks about hell more than any other figure in the New Testament. So you have this extreme gentleness and an extreme power in one. So that's a paradox. And then Chesterton notes that the crucifixion actually also unites an extraordinary paradox. And he hones in on one of the sayings that from Christ, from the cross, his Christ dereliction. He said, I think this contradiction is most evident because, you know, Jesus is quoting from one of the Psalms, my God, why have you forsaken me? So here we have in the crucifixion on the cross, Chesterton writes, we have, you know, God was forsaken of God, which is, again, it's like God was in the manger, but he was fully human and God was forsaken of God. And how does all this fit together? So for Chesterton, and I think he's right, given the profound mysteries of the incarnation and passion of our Lord, and these things are rooted in history too. I mean, that's the other thing, that we have historical documents that we can go and look at this. This isn't just some visions of some prophet somewhere that, you know, that was seeing these things, right? This is actually historically documented for us. So it's very rational and intellectual in that sense, evidential. He concludes that Christianity is uniquely able to navigate these mysterious extremes of this world, this idea that this world is magical and meaningful and full of purpose, even though it is fallen, and we are extremely valuable and meaningful and infinitely valuable to God, even though we're pretty terrible. And Chesterton said that's because of this profound mysteries at the heart of our faith, Christianity is uniquely able to navigate all these mysterious extremes of our world without falling into any of the open traps of error or exaggeration, which have long plagued humanity. I love this quote from him. He said, "It is always simple to fall. There are an infinity of angles at which one falls, only one at which one stands. But to have avoided them all, as Christian has done, has been one whirling adventure. And in my vision, the heavenly chariot flies thundering through the ages." So ultimately, the greatest mystery at the heart of our faith, the God-man that was forsaken of God for our sake and for the sake of a redemption of not only us, but a recreation of the world one day, lays the greatest foundation for enchantment.
Well, I hope our conversation has sparked our listeners to think, I would like to dive into Chesterton's work and learn more about him and read some of his books. And so what would be a good starting point for our listeners? You did rattle off a bunch of different books at the beginning of this podcast. And if they're new to Chesterton, what's a good way to get into his writing in addition to reading Orthodoxy?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot. And I say it really depends on the person. You know, of course, I hope my article inspires people to read Orthodoxy or reread it. I will say Orthodoxy is very hard to take it all in with just one reading. Like I said, it's definitely grounded in reason and rational discourse, but it's very different from picking up a book on Christian apologetics from someone like, say, Dr. William Lane Craig, or say, you know, the Thomistic philosopher Ed Fazer. Very wonderfully great. They've written great books on apologetics, but it's definitely, Chesterton is more poetic.
And also his writing style might not be, you know, what modern readers are used to, because there's so much of value in the classics. And sometimes we need to coax people into, you know, investing into diving into something like Orthodoxy.
Yeah, he was widely read in his day. I always remind myself of this. He was widely read. He was a household name, okay? So think of a journalist today or a social commentator. He was like that person. But his prose is definitely you know, early 1900s, Edwardian era type, you know, prose. So it kind of might seem cumbersome to us busy moderns when we like to get to a point and get there quickly. Chesterton doesn't. So reading him, especially in his apologetics works, I would say is like taking a journey. Now, I often tell people his fiction is a great place to start, especially his detective fiction, because you also get some deep theology in them as well. So his Father Brown series is excellent. If you like kind of surrealist type strange fiction, his I would say The Man Who Was Thursday is like a surrealist thriller. It's also somewhat of a mystery as well. And then, of course, he's written a ton of essays. So there's a lot of collections of his best essays out there. There's one called In Defense of Sanity that I recommend to a lot of people who tend to like essays more. But he also wrote poetry. So I've met people that who love poetry, and they've met Chesterton through poems. He wrote some epic poetry. So I guess it really just depends on your style. I do recommend, especially with his apologetics books, to listen to an audio version as you read along. This kind of helps you get the rhythm of his writing, which is very different. And also, I recommend Trevin Wax, if you know who he is. He's a prominent writer today. He put out a version of Orthodoxy that has a study guide with it. And he also gave some more paragraph breaks. Chesterton could sometimes write a paragraph that could go for several pages. I think he broke a lot of grammar rules. But I mean, he had beautiful grammar, but like broke some of those rules that we are used to today. So Wax adds some more paragraph breaks in there and gives you a sort of summary at the end of each chapter, an introduction. So kind of can help you guide your way through it, because I mean, it's really, Orthodoxy is a journey. It's a journey of a book.
Well, I hope that our listeners are inspired to dig into Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton, and we will link in the show notes here also another resource that we have on the life of Chesterton that we've covered in the last couple of years, the Christian Research Institute. Well, finally, on a much lighter note, it is September, as I mentioned. And of course, as I sometimes say in these podcasts, we have all kinds of just wonky holidays, national days that have been declared about something or other in the United States. Well, in September, we have National Lazy Moms Day. So if you had a lazy mom day where you could do anything that you wanted to relax, what would you do?
Oh my goodness. Okay, I'm going to be very Chestertonian here. I just love naps. I would just take a nap, probably get in a good audiobook. I love detective mysteries. So I've read all the Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes. I'm working my way through Josephine Tay right now, because my mother's been on me to read her for years. And so I would probably do that. I would sit and get a good audiobook and probably fall asleep and wake up multiple times throughout the day. So, because I love naps. So truly, truly lazy.
Very restful, trying to catch up on everything that moms need to catch up on. I think a lot of us wish we had more sleep. So that's a great answer. Well, thanks for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to episode 462 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Rebecca Valerius. She has written an online book review for the Christian Research Journal. Her review is called G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy and Christian Enchantment. You can read this review for free at equip.org.
You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.